I want to talk to you today about the remedy of happiness. The remedy of happiness is one of the more important subjects which you will have to cope with in a pre-plan. It could be said that if all we knew about the human mind was the remedy of happiness, and that's all we knew about the human mind, and that's all we knew how to process, we would know more than the Vedics, the Asclepians, the faith healers of Christianity, the demon exorcists of the Middle Ages, Freudian analysis, psychologists, psychiatrists, or medicine. Now, I just want to give you the slight stress. I didn't want to overrate this, you see. I wanted to give you the slight stress on this particular process. Now, just because some new process comes along, you know, or because I happen to write something saying this and this happens with a prequel, does not mean that the remedy of happiness disappears as a process. In fact, I can tell you very, very bluntly and very frankly that there are seven things that are not going to disappear as a process. And these seven are two-way communication, elementary straight wire opening procedure, AC opening procedure by duplication, remedy to having a spotting spot in space, and the chart of human evaluation. And these are not going to vanish. These aren't something you're just looking at for a minute and then going to be out of communication with it sometime in the future. Every single process there is evolves one way or the other from these seven things. Now, it's a very, very important thing then for you to know all these processes. But amongst these, the remedy of happiness. One of the reasons you have to know the remedy of happiness is to understand human behavior. That's just one reason you have to know. Another reason you have to know the remedy of happiness is to be able to tell in Scientology why and what the awareness unit, the Satan, is trying to do or is doing or how he feels when he's trying to exteriorize. And happiness as a subject is the key to exteriorization. And happiness itself as a subject is a major key, if not the major key, to psychosomatic illness. Happiness, of course, is part of the scale be, do, have. Beingness is space. Doingness is energy. Havingness is matter. And we're here living on Earth, which is a very solid planet. And we're associated with bodies which are quite solid. And we deal every day with tools and vehicles and houses and other things which are quite solid. Well, now, how exactly do these things influence human behavior? Well, they influence it very, very intimately indeed. You are under a stress by reason of happiness, of which you are very unaware consciously. Been under this stress for so long that you pay no further attention to it. That's gravity. Gravity is a manifestation of happiness. When you have a solidity, such as a planet, it itself is in continuous and continual terminal exchange with a body or another mass. And people get that on an unconscious level. They're not conscious of this at all. And they begin to dramatize it by having to have and wanting the flow, terminal manifestation. And that is gravity. So much mass is there that the mass itself attracts to it other masses. That's gravity. And that's also wantingness. That's appetite. That's why here on Earth people eat people. Animals eat people. People eat animals. at this station. I know three or four of those you don't think of as routine or ordinary. But that's merely because you live in a civilized part of Earth where it is frowned upon.
People eating people.
Sex, by the way, is simply a substitute for eating.
It's the lower scale substitute for eating.
You wonder about that? Well, I advise you sometime to run a pre-clear on the basis of men eating women and women eating men. And he will have more rich manifestations than any other technique. I can call mine right on hand. So after a while, he decided they would have something to put out which would continue into the future. And a big figure took place and they got sex. But eatingness and gravity and havingness and all of these other manifestations are very, very, very closely intimated. Very intimate, one with another. They are very closely associated, and the manifestation which you normally see in a pre-clear is that of havingness. Now let's take up one of the manifestations of havingness, we call it loss. You know, when somebody loses something, he feels so very bad. You want to know what degradation is. Degradation is nothing more nor less than loss. If you were to take somebody who was very accustomed to and subjected to gravity and put him out there in the sky 100,000 miles, you would discover that he would be suffering from such tremendous degradation that he would be unable to remember where he was or to what body he belonged. Now, we're talking now about the awareness unit. You put him 100,000 feet up in the sky, bing, he would be so degraded, he would not really know what body he belonged to or anything else. He would have no recall on the basis, unless you remedied his havingness with mock-ups, something of the sort, and then he would remember. Well, now, what would happen if you put a person in a rocket ship? He's in a body, and he's in a rocket ship, and here he is subjected to all his gravity, and he has this big mass of Earth, this big planet, and you lit the fire to the rocket, and he went out there at many G's acceleration and got way out into outer space. Now, what do you suppose would happen to him? Very much the same thing as though you suddenly exteriorized somebody 100,000 miles away from Earth. See, loss of mass would bring about a feeling of degradation. Now, what would happen to a sailor who was fighting a war and he was on a battleship? And he was on this battleship and a great many torpedoes hit it and it sank. Boom. He'd have immediate feeling of great degradation. Now, what would happen if he were on a destroyer? It goes by ratio. He would not feel quite so degraded. And if he only lost a rowboat, he would probably merely swear. Now, what rationale is there behind this? What possible rationale lies behind this? There is no rationale behind this. There are no reasons why. But a Satan can add a lot of reasons why to have it. You see, he can add a lot of it. But the fact of the matter is, it is a problem in having it. Now, havingness works the reverse. We take somebody who is 100,000 miles outside Earth, and we take him and we just shut him down on Earth. You see, he's subjected to all his gravity and so forth. Very many things could happen to him. One of the things could happen to him, he'd get a tremendous resurgence and he'd feel awfully good. But at the same time, he could also feel awfully degraded. Not the same feeling of degradation, however. He would feel glutted. Have you ever eaten too much? Feel torpid, stupid, sort of hypnotized. You ever felt that way from eating too much? Be the same thing as you took somebody out here 100,000 miles out and you suddenly and immediately put him on the surface of the planet. Now, havingness originally was the simple matter of mock-ups and so forth, but this went into a further consideration, and havingness and impacts became very intimately connected. And so we have havingness and impact being to all intents and purposes the same thing. You go up and hit the wall, and you will have some havingness. The havingness is the impact itself. Now, basically, the awareness unit does not need this impact and really does not want this impact. But after it's been given a few impacts, then it has to have. See? What's happened is its resistance has been overcome so that when it tries to outflow, it inflows. That's an inversion, and that's what's meant by inversion. The person tries to outflow, he inflows. In other words, he exactly reverses his consideration on the thing. Then somebody has to have an impact. You say it's idiotic that somebody's driving out the road out here who's just absolutely... Did you ever see anybody who was real hungry? If you saw a piece of food and slapper come out? There are people driving on this highway out there who are so hungry for impacts that they're actually quiveringly eager to smack something. It's just eager. Yeah, that's insane. Well, they might be insane, but they're still licensed by state police all over the United States. They walk in. They give them a license to have impacts. Now, you see, at first they don't want impacts. They don't want them, don't want them, don't want them, don't want them, don't want them. That means they'll start out pulling against them, rigid, rigid, and then that scream will get in closer and closer. They mustn't have this impact, they mustn't have this impact. Apathy, well, I guess we'll have the impact. At the same time, the person starts the desire to have an impact, you get a shift of valence. Now, you know what a shift of valence is from book one. That merely means taking on the identity of another mass. Taking on the identity of another mass is an inversion. Here's an awareness unit that is caught in a mass of energy. It's an enlarged mass of energy. After a little while, it will begin to think of itself as energy. You run beingness processing on this person. It's an experimental process, and you will discover something quite curious. You will discover that the person believes himself to be the mass of energy. He believes it so implicitly and so thoroughly that no argument on your part could ever convince him otherwise. Now, we ask him, be yourself, be the energy mass. Be yourself, be the energy mass. Be yourself, be the energy mass. He is one thing after the other. And the first thing you know, the most horrible feeling of apathy and degradation and so forth will come over him. He's just now gotten onto the tone scale. Just that moment got onto the tone scale, like you see. You're actually causing him to lose that mass of that trap. Or that body, or that energy mass, you see. But the manifestation is that he was the energy mass. Now, as we start asking to be the mass, be yourself, be the mass, be yourself, be the mass, be yourself, first thing you know, he's aware of it. One of the curious things is you start that process as an experimental process. You start that process, you get into this kind of a manifestation with the person. He will tell you, if you're processing with Scientology, you know, there's Satan in here someplace. There's a Satan in here someplace. I just know that. And similarly, individuals who fight this idea of being an energy space production unit, an awareness unit, Satan, rather than a body. The people who fight the idea and say, I am a body, I am a body. Actually, if you processed them a little while, I would start to tell you about some demon or something of this sort that was chasing them or that haunted them or they had a Satan in the front of their forehead or in their stomach or something like that. They're talking about themselves. And if you were to run them on this process or other process of saying, now, be a Satan, be yourself, be a Satan, pardon me, be a body, be yourself, be a body, be yourself, be a body, be yourself, and they say, well, I'm being a body, so I'll be myself, and so on. So they start to differentiate. First thing you know, wham! He becomes this demon. Or something or other that he claims has been haunting him, and boy, will he feel degraded. Well, actually, it's loss of mass that causes the degradation. He shifted his identity, and he will go back. If you don't run it very long afterwards and run that on left flank, he will just suffer to go back and be that body rather than to have that horrible feeling of degradation. Oh, he will suffer. That's a horrible feeling of degradation. Until a person's been run through something like that, they wouldn't have any idea of how degraded maybe some tramp or general or bum might possibly feel. By the way, just take a general, for instance. You take a general and detaching from his army. See, loss of happiness can mean to be a thing. This is so much the case that we expect it as normal course of human events that a great loss will immediately result in the person feeling he has failed. So that if you were to take something away from somebody suddenly, he would then tell you he had failed. He hadn't failed. back and attach himself to that mass again.
You'll see. Then he would not have.
Most Thetans have the motto, anything in terms of happiness is better than nothing. Anything is better than nothing. As a result, you get such manifestations with Freudian hoarding of excretia. You know, people will actually cache this stuff and so forth. You get people who are terribly constipated.
Going to another fellow.
You get the fellow who cannot possibly empty his desk. You get the electrician whose entire workshop is completely littered with old burned-out tubes and busted transformers and completely unworkable pieces of junk. But boy, it's there. It's mashed, you see. And we get a woman and her purse.
Look into a woman's purse, or you'll see some interesting things.
Now, as a person starts to deteriorate, they begin to attach great importance to any happiness there is. And they will save little slips of paper and get masses and masses and masses of paper. You know, they get as psychotic as General Electric. I imagine General Electric has files that go back to 10 years before they began. And they say these little pieces of paper. Now, one poor psychotic lady went so far one time to give to somebody a very precious dispatch, which this other person trustingly sent on to me. Well, this was for Ron, I think. And it was sent registered special delivery. And it was insured for a very large sum. And when I got it out, it was old grocery receipt. They've been scribbled all over, years old, you know. But there was this terribly valuable package, these pieces of paper. So awfully bad. Just a piece of mass. Well, now, what can a person have? This is the first question you ask of a pre-clear when you're processing on happiness. You ask him, now, what could he really have? And, by the way, that isn't the process. I mean, the auditor simply looks at the preacher, you see, and he asks himself, what could this person have? Or he could even ask the preacher as a straight wire question, what could you really have? And the preacher will flounder along, and by the way, a $5 com lag would not be extraordinary on this. And the individual finally get down to realizing that he could have the shadow of an old inner tube. He couldn't have the inner tube. He could have the shadow of the inner tube. And an auditor doesn't realize or recognize when he's processing most pre-clears that he's dealing with this sort of thing. He sees them sitting there. He's looking at all their social responses. He believes they can have a body. He believes that they can have possessions because they're wearing clothes. Well, he thinks immediately they can have clothes. They can have shoes because they drive a car. He thinks they can have a car. Well, the funny part of it is they can't have a car. Quite ordinarily. The car's going to pieces under them, and strange things are getting wrong with it. As far as their shoes are concerned, well, it's just social. We wear shoes. They would actually not either be happier or unhappier if they were suddenly to lose their shoes, but they might not be anywhere near as concerned as you would think, because they're not their shoes. Everything they have, every identity that they possess, all their possessions and so forth, are really kind of bodily somebody else's. Now, the police, by the way, are always trying to take possession of people's bodies. As any race of demons operating in a civilization will do, they're always body hungry. And they try to find reasons why they can take people's bodies and do things with them. And you think, by the way, there's a big rationale to the operation of police. There isn't. There isn't. They go according to certain laws, and people frown on them, so step too wide. But they want to put bodies into closed cubicles or into electric chairs or something. But they want to possess or own these bodies. And it's just a matter of mass. Now, here we get some, speaking of the less respected strata of society, here we have an admiral. Here we have an admiral, and we set him up, and we do the unfortunate thing of appointing him to head a naval base. This naval base was getting along all right. It was doing all right. Maybe the country was at war or something of the sort. And this admiral gets in charge of this naval base. Now, honest. He won't send any ships out of there. Every ship that comes in stays there. You say in the war this couldn't happen, not when they need ships on the high seas to fight submarines and all that sort of thing. No, no, they they will accumulate ships, for instance, like little yachts for private yachtsmen, this admiral will. And he'll accumulate those and he'll rig them up, you know, and put a naval flag on them, which means they're home. And then they sit there in the harbor. And they're heavily manned. Men, you know, mass. And the next thing you know, why, you start transferring drafts and therefore retransfers to ships. And you find out that you just can't get them retransferred to ships. And you can't get ships dispatched out of that area. In other words, it's getting a bigger and bigger lump. Well, you'll discover after a while that this naval base has to have additional land in this direction and additional docks in that direction and additional anchorages out that way and more warehouses down that way to house more things in there that won't be issued either. Now, trying to get something out of the Admiral's supply officer becomes almost impossible. So it is the routine thing that combat ships coming into that area, they recognize this, they have to bribe or steal what they need to go on and fight for. I have seen an admiral seated in this capacity accumulate to himself 1,000 seamen first class when there was such a scarcity of ships at sea fighting a war that it was hardly possible to find anybody to steer. Now, a seaman first class is able to steer. They send you a lieutenant seaman or somebody of the sort, or seaman second class. You say, where are all of the seaman first class? And I saw an example of this one time. Seaman first class had been ordered to this base, you see, for this admiral in charge. He, of course, had accumulated them, and then he couldn't let them go. And he had them there sweeping a dry dock. There was one dry dock, and he used 1,000 seamen first class to keep it swept. It had to be swept every couple of 3 weeks when new ships went in. So, very important. Look at their offices. First they hire somebody to expedite their dispatches, and then this person has to have a secretary, and then that secretary has to have secretaries, and then there have to be other departments, and now there are more departments, and having this, accumulative, and the more mass there is, the less outflow. Now how many ships, airplanes, space wagons, bodies, and so forth, do you suppose have left the surface of Earth in the last 10 days? And gone out into outer space? Well, there just haven't been any, have they? This is called gravity. When it gets that big, it gets a dignified name called gravity. When it's a little kid wanting a sucker, it's called selfishness or greediness. No essential difference between these two things. All right, our psycho sits there on the couch. You want this psycho to discharge the charge out of one locker. Their husband brought them in, you see, and there they sit. And you say, well, this is the idea of the husband being here on this one. Oh, no, you don't. No, that lock won't discharge. I can remember it, but it's solid. Their memory is solid. They can't have anything else, so they can have engrams. So they can have blackness. So they can have locks. And these things are held to them by the same manifestation that you might call gravity. They become very solid. And you try to get them by straight recall and elementary straight wire to release one lock. A time that you really wouldn't mind forgetting. And this person is just, they can remember it. It doesn't release. This is what used to drive Dionysus mad. This fellow could run an engram, and he could run it, but it never desensitized. The answer to that was havingness. His havingness was very low. He had lost too much in life, and he couldn't give up a memory. Now, worse than that, there's just that psycho, and you ask the psycho, would you hand me your, let's be very unsmart, and say, well, hand me your purse. Right straight up to her chest, clutch. It's an old Kleenex thing. So you as an auditor say to her, well, how about giving me that old, used, secondhand Kleenex? Oh! I've seen an auditor work at this for an hour and finally get the person to trust the purse that was being clutched in his back and to trust the purse down alongside of the cow. In other words, let it out of her hand so that she could snatch it, but no further distance than that. All right, there is acquisitiveness, there is hattiness, there is a person compulsively and completely holding on to engrams, locks, black masses, screens, all these other manifestations that we know about through auditing and Dianetics. There's this person holding on to it. And you think you're going to get this person to give up an aberration or an idea or a psychosis or anything of the sort? Oh, no. They're just going to grip, 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 tighter and tighter and tighter. Now, they will invert music. That's bad. They will invert so that they obsessively cannot have anything near them. You get the inversion and a reinversion and a reinversion. When they put out to reach, they actually pull in. Well, that will invert to a point where they obsessively push away. And you will find somebody who is quite mad, throwing, you'll find these lighter manifestations of the bank in sane people, but in mad people it's quite obvious. This person, if you dressed him, would throw his clothes away from him. See, throw everything away from him. Now, this person also is liable to obsessively exteriorize. And because the psychiatrist has seen this occur, he knows exteriorization is an insanity. It's a manifestation of psychiatric paranoia, schizobula. Actually, the person isn't exteriorizing at all. The person is just obsessively fighting away from the body and doesn't want any contact with it. Really is not outside with perception, which is what we call exteriorization. Now, in Dianetics, you'll see somebody then doing this trick to you as an auditor. This is the other side of the picture. This is unhappy. And you sit down to audit them, and they just start throwing engrams at you. Zoom, 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 zoom. You start to run an engram. You get at the beginning of birth, you know. And all right, now let's take up what the doctor said. But they're running an incident 2 years old. Oh, no, let's take up birth. Now it's a prenatal. Now we started to run birth again. Now it's a 16-year-old incident they're running. See what they're doing? Now, watch that other manifestation. This is the throwaway case. They're just all over the bank, just obsessively, I've got to get rid of this, I've got to get rid of that, I've got to show this off, I've got to get rid of the other one. Now you'll get cases that have these two things in sort of combination. They will shift. At one time they've got to grab everything in their chest, and the next time you do anything about it, they're going to throw everything at you. They will even go so far as to pick up things and throw them at you when they audit you. The other person will take things of yours with them when they leave the auditing session. Now, to a person who's having this is in poor condition, a word becomes a precious object. A word is an object. A symbol is solid. When a person does not have sufficient havingness and has a craving for havingness, symbols become solid. That's why engrammatic commands have such a terrific force upon such people. They're preserving and holding every word that comes their way. So he walks down the street to them and says, "How are you?" Well, now, as you know about as-isness, as-ising things, erases them, this person then, in order to possess this thing, can't look at the salutation, "How are you?" They have to do this. They hold "How are you?" to their bosom, and then they don't look at this. They look beyond it, under it, on the back side of it, something of the sort. What did he mean when he said, "How are you?" In Latin countries and amongst Californians, where you have very hot sun, it wouldn't matter what you did. If you picked up a fork alongside of your plate and put something in your mouth, there would be somebody in the restaurant wondering what was the deep significance of this. See, their obsessive happiness is such that they just can't look at anything, because if they looked at something directly and straightly, it would erase, you understand, and then they wouldn't have it. So their way of keeping these things and holding them and not letting them erase is to always say they are something else. Now, you say to this person, "How are you?" And this person then has something else as his primary motive in dealing with you. You say, "How are you?" And he will want to know why you were asking him that. You see what the motive is there. Now, let's tack this on the cause and effect and discover that all he's really trying to do is find basic original cause, which is never attainable, or find basic last effect, which again is never attainable. And so when he goes to deal and researches in the field of the mind, he wants to know the reason why all of this universe came into existence. He wants to know from what it stems. He's not interested in getting well or anything of the sort. All he does is inquire as to what was the expression on God's face when he first made man happy. Beside the point. You'll see these people around. They're doing this with everything. Nothing is as it is. There is no as-isness to existence at all. Now, you ask this person in opening procedure of AC, touch that wall, and his concept of the wall is that there's something out there. You ask him to touch a wall, and finally, after he's done this many times, many hours, he finally discovers, by touching various walls and objects, that it is what it is. A wall. That's all you're trying to teach him. You're getting him over this idea of trying to avoid as-ising everything. This person is low on happiness. Almost any human being there is will get into this sort of a condition. Sooner or later, he will lose something. He will feel that something is irreparable to him. And after that, he feels he can't have things of that order, but can have things of a lower order. You will find you get somebody, you have somebody around. This is acceptance level I give you in one of the PAPs, acceptance level. There's a very, very good thing for an auditor to know. His acceptance level deteriorates. He can't have the better things. He can have the worst things. And then amongst these worst things, he can't have the better or the worst things, you see. He only can have worse things than that. And so we get a dwindling spiral to where somebody will actually associate with the lowest dregs of humanity and would not associate with somebody who wouldn't bring the pick. Now, they see something beautiful, they try to make nothing out of it. That's because they can't have it. They say, no, I don't. That's something wrong with it. Now, if you were to go down and you were to buy the best-looking suit and the best-looking tie and the finest-looking car, you were to dress yourself up looking real good, you would drive most of the people you ran into immediately afterwards into a sort of a shuddering fit because you confronted them with things they can't have. But their expression is not a conscious expression. Their expression is simply, cut rid of it somehow. See, I've got to cut this down somehow. And they'll find something wrong with your haircut, your suit, and your car. Now, if you were to drive up to these same people in an old, broken-down jalopy, wearing old, stained clothes, with your hair shaggy, and so forth, they say, my friend, you're acceptable to them. Now, to Daddy and Mom, who never gave any interest to the healthy child, but always hovered over the sick one, we have a child convinced that he cannot have good health. The only thing he can have is ill health. So the interest actually lies as background music to this. All right, let's take up some of the factors involved in this. And we find the scale of substitutes. When a person loses something, he can only have a substitute for it. I'm not going to read you the scale of substitutes now because it's lying right in front of you in the printed edition of the auditor's handbook. And toward the end of the processing section there, under loss, you discover the scale of substitutes. It's a very interesting scale. It's not terribly important to you, but it just demonstrates to you what are these different kinds of cases you're looking at. Well, the kind of case is what the person is substituting for. That's just what he's using as a substitute. All right. There's the high to curiosity scale. Now, this is one of the more important discoveries of Scientology. And this is quite vital to know. Scale of substitutes, that's merely interesting. This one you've got to know. Did you ever hear the DEI scale? Desire, enforce, inhibit. It goes actually curiosity. A person's curious about something, and then he desires that something, and then his desire is enforced, and then his desire for it is inhibited. You see that? In other words, he desires it, he has to have it, he can't have it. Desire, enforce, inhibit. That scale continues downward. And these two scales, which were previously considered two scales, are actually only one scale. There's another scale. And it goes bottom up. Hide, protect, own. Now you know that scale. That's the sub-zero tone scale. The DEI scale joins the sub-zero tone scale. So that you get a scale that goes like this. Hide, protect, own, inhibit, enforce, desire, curious. And that is the scale. It's an odd thing that these two scales stood independently so long, actually belong together, one below the other. And I repeat that scale for you again. It's hide at the bottom, then protect, then own, then inhibit, and then enforce, and then desire. And of course, to the top of that, we would have curious about, and this is the scale of happiness. Curious about what? Curious about an object. Enforcing what? Enforcing an object in happiness could be pro too. That would be in the doingness of this. And we're studying happiness right now as the more important manifestation. And then we would have inhibit. Can't have it. In other words, anytime you enforce somebody into having something, you force him to have this thing, he sooner or later will find that he or you will inhibit his happiness. And after that, we have to have ownership. That decides who wants it. You see, now we have to have ownership. Up to that time, ownership was not vital. But now we can lay deed of title to these things. We can say, that's your shirt, and these are my shoes. And then we don't get into this desire and force inhibit. If you don't have to wear my shoes, and I'm not inhibited from wearing your shirt. We've just settled the whole thing. You own your shirt, and I own my shoes. And now, after a person no longer can own, he has to start protecting. Now, wait a minute. Below own, you just protect? You certainly do. You don't really protect something that you really own. You just have it, it's yours to use. But then you become worried about it. And you own it, but now you've got to protect it too. And so you've got a tie that you like real well, and here is what happens eventually to that tie. You like this tie, then your father or somebody takes it out of the closet and wears it, and you come up to him and you say, look, that's my tie. No, that's my tie, you see. You've gone out of just hinting that he shouldn't wear it, you see, and into, that's my tie, I own that tie, and you are not to wear it. Okay, you're the party. You're the party, and a girl spills some wine on it or something of that sort. And, you know, so you decide, oh, I'm going to wear it like this, and I'm going to stick it back in the shirt. But you're in. You're protecting that tie now. And now you find out when you put it in the closet, just so your father won't get it and wear it again, you see. You fail to really establish any of your points all the way down the line. This is the clue of this. You never do establish any of these points. You put it at the back of the closet, not with the rest of your ties. That's to protect it. The motive was to protect it, but you have hid it. It is now hidden. The first thing you know, you won't wear that tie at all. You'll protect it to the degree that you have hidden it utterly. And it'll do nothing but stay in the closet. And 25 years later, when they're assembling your effects, to send them home to your fifth wife, somebody will run across this tie. And he'll say, what do you know, a tie? Here it is. You know, what's that thing? Well, I guess I'll keep it. I'll wear it. I'll wear the tie. And the fellow wears the tie. And then somebody says, you know, that's a lousy looking tie. So, oh, I'm going to wear this tie whether you like it or not. Where's it anyhow? Wife doesn't like it or something. And she keeps nagging at him. You know, wear the tie. Finally, he says, now look, it's my tie. And if I want to wear it, I will. And somehow, inexplicably, this tie gets lost for a week. She loses it for him. So it's protected now. And the next person that got the tie put it in the drawer. 25 years after that, when somebody's sending his effects home to his eighth wife, somebody finds this tie. We can assume that this was a cast iron tie that lasted this long, but that's the way things go. And that is the history of an object. And that is therefore the history of happiness, and this is the dwindling spiral of happiness. When we do to the mind, we look over this, and we will understand an awful lot about what people are doing. All right. Let's get into expanded deepa. You've got that in the printed edition of your auditor's handbook under SOTA Step 4. You should know that step. You know that step real well. But there's more today to expanded deepa. We apply this whole scale that I've just told you about to expand the gene pool. And we will specialize on most people when they're having a difficult time with something to find hidden manifestations of it. When their communication lag comes off on this, you know, they're lacking in cars, let's say, point out, find some hidden cars, you know, point them out. Pretty soon the communication lag will get fat. All right, now let's look over some protected cars, you know, and they point these out, that your palm light comes off of that. Let's look over some owned cars, point these out, communication light comes off of that. Now we'll have to get into some inhibited cars, and we point those out, palm light comes off of that. Now some enforced cars, we point those out until a calm light comes out of that. Some desired cars, well, it really isn't necessary to rent it. He'll want a car. But you could run it further, and he would even run out his curiosity about cars. What we are doing is improving his consideration. Any process which does this, by the way, is a process known as improving one's consideration. That is the name of that type of process. You know, we have him point out things or remember things each time better than the last until he's as is from the bottom up to the top and each consideration is free. That's how you get out of a trap. You better your consideration about the trap. All right. Mock-ups and engrams are also a problem of habits. And when you take the Scientology edition of self-analysis or take the old Dianetic edition of self-analysis and convert it by telling people to mock these things up, call formalism. See, rather than have to recall it, just every time you find the word recall in self-analysis, the Dianetic edition, you see, anytime you find the word recall in those lists, just substitute the word mock-up and you've converted the whole edition. There's no further trick than that. And you just ask people, mock these things up. Some interesting things will occur if you just did that. But there would be a better way to go about it. You ask him to mock this thing up, which is called for there, and then pull it in on himself. Mock him up, and pull him in. And what do you think flies off the case? Engrams. Well, how could engrams fly off if you simply pull in mock-ups? Because it's a problem in mass. It's not a problem in consideration. It's a problem in mass. Now, get that straight? It's a problem in mass. Anytime you think in terms of happiness, for heaven's sakes, think of it as a problem in mass. Not a problem in reasons. The guy's got reasons to justify the fact that he has or doesn't have. But the main thing is the mass. And reasons are no reasons, there's the mass. So we get this process then supplanting actually the held in suspension engrams. Why are these engrams in suspension? It's because they are pictures taken of the environment by putting out a flood of energy against the environment and getting a print at moments of loss. A fellow outfloods at the environment. The cells, you know, they admire, they try to surrender, they say, look, I'll be good, and they take a picture of their assailant. You know, they're trying to resist it, and they put up that much energy and so forth, and they get a picture. They get a smooth motion picture, and this, you could say, gets filed. Now, that is a protest against happiness. Every time you get one of these things, which is a protest against loss or a protest against happiness, either way, protest against loss, by the way, is a tractor effect. They take pictures backwards. You have to try to pull things back to them, and they get a print of the other side. They'll hold on to these things because each one of them was held on to at the moment of loss or acquisition of something undesirable. And so here these things are, and that's an engram in its basic fundamentals. The cells still keep on taking pictures after the analytical mind goes out. And you get these masses of pictures, and havingness itself insists. You see, the fellow begins to believe he wants, and he actually pulls in upon himself the most undesirable consideration simply because he has to have that mass. And he pulls that mass in on himself, and he holds it to himself, and so he gets back ones, and he gets everything you can think of in re-stimulation there because he's pulled these masses in on. Now, if you want to run out somebody's happiness, let's exhaust engrams off the case. Don't be surprised if they're getting harder and harder to exhaust because you're reducing somebody's happiness by exhausting those engrams. You're erasing them.
And therefore, the erasure of engrams is limited as a process. What limits it? Because you run out of the bank just so much energy, and the individual will then begin to seize large masses of energy and hold them in. And he'll hold them stronger, and he'll hold more of them. That's why, obviously, every time that we had done a lot of erasure on somebody in the current lifetime, we would get past life engrams. Inevitable, wasn't it? He had remedies adding this somehow, so the easy way to do it was not to create anything, but simply to pull in the old stuff on himself. Not to get new pictures, but to pull in the old pictures. And so he started doing that. And he was doing that. He was using this set of pictures, but the basic use of all this, if you want to understand the service facsimile, is simply to have. And that's the total explanation. Now, you run remedy of having this on this individual, and we get the most interesting release of engrams you ever want to see in your life. Honest, it's quite remarkable to see somebody who has been audited for a long time suddenly have engrams that are half or all erased, he thinks, flying away from him, caving in, disappearing. You're remedying the happiness. How do you remedy happiness? You remedy it two ways. If a person had too much, you could have him throw things away. You know, the dispersal characters? Well, you just have him mock up things and throw them away, and mock them up and throw them away, and the first thing you know, he'll stabilize. He no longer does it obsessively. That's remedying happiness. That's why we don't call it grabbing on to happiness, or pulling in energy, or pulling in masses, or adding mass. We don't call it any of those things. We call it remedying happiness. One of the remedies to having is to throw something away. And the other side is to pull something in. So you'll get a free clear on either side of this. You would ask him to mock up something and throw it away, or mock up something and throw it away. Or you would ask him to mock up something and pull it in on himself. What do we mean by himself? His body, of course, at first, and then as a latent, something else. Now, he very often, he's one of these reason why fellows, has to have a big reason why. So he has to have substance and reason and meaning in the mock-ups he makes. Because he'll do that after a short time. Another manifestation of remedy of havingness is simply this, the starting of avalanches. You must know something about this. You have a fellow mock up a small planet or something, or a grain of dust, and he pulls it in on himself. He mocks it up and pulls it in. He mock up another one, pull it in. Mock up another one, pull it in. Mock up another one, pull it in. Now, can you mock up a pebble? Mock up a pebble, pull it in. Pebble, pull it in. Can you mock up a rock? Yeah, rock and pull it in. It's a good and dense sword. Okay. Mock up a rock and pull it in. Mock up a rock and pull it in. Now, do you suppose you could mock up a small satellite? Oh, yes, there's one. All right. Why don't you mock up a couple of those at a time and pull it in? You do that? Sure. Now, let's start mocking up a planet. Black planets, by the way, work wonderfully well. Boy, when you run into a black planet, you really know it. You see, the reason a black star or a black planet is black is because the energy which it is emanating goes out just so far and that its own gravity pulls it back in on itself. So, of course, the light doesn't escape, so you don't see it. If photons hit it, they stay there. That's a black planet. All right, you'd have him pull some of these in. Pull them back, mark up another black planet, pull it in. Mark up another black planet, pull it in. Don't be surprised if all of a sudden, with a tremendous roar, the whole heavens start to fall in on this fellow. Planets, stars, moons, anything you can think of just start coming in with a roar. What do you do in a case like that? Just have him add to the mass coming in. Have him add to it as he can. You know, just add to it, bring it in faster, and add to it, bring it in faster. An avalanche may last an hour. May not happen at all. It may last an hour. It may last 3 days. This roar. Well, what will happen while that avalanche is roaring? You've broken through some kind of a resistance, and the resistance now is being drunk up by the inflow. And engrams will appear. The time his mother slapped him and so forth will appear. If you were to stop while you were running a remedy of happiness on somebody to treat an engram, oh, you've just missed the whole point of happiness, eh? All right, all of a sudden you've got this avalanche started on this pre-clear, and boy, the engrams are flying off like mad in all directions. And suddenly, here's this big facsimile of his big brother about to choke him. The facsimile is right in front of his face, maybe it's the first one he ever saw, and is he upset about this, you see? The auditor who would process that would be in direct disobedience to the auditor's code, where it says that because the frequency changed, the auditor shouldn't change. Code pull in some more plants, and you'll see that whole facsimile flow. It will actually disintegrate. This mass will no longer be so precious that it will be held to the prequel. See that? Now, there can be an outflowing avalanche, too, and those things will sometimes start going obsessively. And they'll just run and run and run and run and run. Let them run. Only have the prequel add to them, add to them, add to them. The general law back of all auditing. Get this general law back of all auditing. Make the pre-clear do what is happening. Whatever's happening, make the pre-clear do it. You know, he's got a whirling dervish dancing in front of his face. All right, make him dance. Make him put another whirling dervish there and make the same one dance. You say, but I can't control it at all. Well, every once in a while, every cue ticks, make his left leg jerk while he's dancing. My first thing you know, he makes both legs jerk, and the next thing you know, he's got the whole dervish under his control. Getting something under control, then, is merely accomplished by having the pre-clear do it. Very important piece of auditing, all right? So we start an avalanche, you have the pre-clear do it. So an avalanche starts, inward or outward, you have the pre-clear do it. Now, the basic auditing demands of the remedy of having it is simply this. Put something out in front of you. Get a mock-up of something. You don't care how thin it is, how unsubstantial, how unreal. Certainty has no place in the remedy of happiness. Remember that. This is one place where it has no place. Because things get real and unreal and back and forth while you're remedying happiness on a free period. No certainty involved in it at all. You say, get a mock-up out in front of you. Get some kind of an energy mass. Mock up one. Any command of that character. All right, now take that and pull it in on yourself. You say you can't do that? Well, can you take that and throw it away? Oh, you can. Well, mark up another one and throw it away. Mark up another one and throw it away. Mark up another one and throw it away. Mark up another one and another one and another one, another one, another one, another one, another one. This is not going back. You got rid of something. Or, if you went in on him, mark up something, it didn't matter what, see. He may want to mark up something very significant. You as an auditor know that it doesn't matter how damn what he marks up. Density and mass are the only thing you want. But in order to make life more palatable for him or something of the sort, you will permit him to add significance to it. So you will permit him to mock up his mother or cash register or something and pull it in on himself. Pull it in the other way. You know, pull it in, pull it in, pull it in, pull it in, pull it in. Mock it up, pull it in, mock it up, pull it in. You don't care if it flies in automatically. You're not so dependent on authenticity and auditing anyway. And you keep having mock it up and pull it in, mock it up and pull it in. Now I have him mock up two and pull it in. Two. And pulling it, or two of the problems. Whichever one he was doing, outflow or inflow. Two. Now let's see if you can get real high. Make it four. Now, if you're going to make it four, make him put it up in the corners, in the shape of the corners of the box. And now you've got space starting. See? So the top corners of the box would be the first four, and you want to get those other four in there too, so that you get eight corners to this box. And preferably, you want these eight corners, each one equidistant from him, so he's in the center of the box. And having marked them up, you pull them in. Having marked them up and pull them in. Mark them up and pull them in. Mark them up and pull them in. And that is really the only way you remedy haddingness on somebody when he's exteriorized. You simply have him put up, build him up to a point where he can put up eight anchor points, eight masses, eight black planets, eight anything, and pull them in. Put him up, pull him in, put him up and pull him in. Your Satan, when he does not have any happiness at all, gets very unhappy indeed. He gets unhappy. So you remedy that unhappiness, and you'll be all set. Now, very often, some of the cases you will audit will become cheerless, unhappy, upset, and so forth. If they do get upset, you, as the auditor, have probably, one way or the other, or no matter how unwittingly, have upset their happiness. The remedies of happiness. Now you use this step anytime, any place, doesn't matter where. But it goes along with the next one you have, which is spotting spots in space. Now, elementary straight wire, any kind of straight wire, is actually remedying happiness to some slight degree by remembering these things that freeze energy masses. See that? You're talking to remedies his happiness. You're there, aren't you? You're in communication with him, aren't you? Therefore, you're part of his happiness the moment you're talking to him. The reason people won't talk to other people is because they don't want to unlatch that much happiness.
You know, get rid of that word. A word would be a very valuable thing.
Now, the difference is scarcity and abundance. Or scarcity things versus abundance of things. But how does something get valuable? The mechanics of something becoming valuable are the mechanics of it getting scarce. When you see something that is valuable, you will have to assume immediately that it is scarce. That it got valuable because it became scarce. The way to make it unvaluable would be the remedy of having it. Now, supposing this fellow was in love, he was desperately in love, and he just unconquerably, horribly bashed in the head on the subject. The only girl in the world, he will tell you. That makes her a little scared. But having mocked this girl up and remedy his happiness with her. You know, mock her up, remedy his happiness. Mock her up, remedy his happiness. Mock her up, remedy his happiness. He said, yeah, she's a nice girl. I've always had nice girls. Mock her up, remedy his happiness. Mock her up, remedy his happiness. Mock up eight of her. Remedy his happiness. See? Next thing you know, he can take her to leave the world. Oh, you say we mustn't do such things as completely upset love affairs and families. Well, whether you know it or not, you will. In the wake of Dianetics and Scientology, there are a lot of broken marriages, which never should have been consummated in the first place. We bring people up to the line to a point where they can fight, and then they get divorced. Okay, I don't say that divorce is an inevitable consequence of being processed. As a matter of fact, twice as many people have settled into a happy married state through processing this have blown up the other way. But marriage is an unstable situation. You take dynamite like Dianetics or Scientology and throw it at it, and God knows what's going to occur. All right. We look this over, and we find out there's one other fact that you have to know about this, and that's overt acts and motivators. When a person does something, he puts some energy out, he expects the energy back. So when he does something bad, he expects something bad to happen to him, doesn't he? That's simply under the heading of remedy and happiness. Yeah, overt acts and motivators, of course. Now, we have flows and terminals. When you set up two terminals, they'll discharge one against the other. We already have mentioned that. And we have this process, two things can't occupy the same space. What wouldn't you mind occupying your same space? The same space you're occupying is a tremendous process and actually boosts a person out of having to have happiness. Very important process. It's in the printed edition of your handbook. A very, very important process because this is the background of happiness. Happiness can only exist as long as two things can't occupy the same space. Happiness is the antithesis of affinity. You see what affinity is? Now, we already talked about affinity. Let's fit that into happiness. Significance and problems, of course, are secondary, really, to happiness. Really are. But there can get such a scarcity of problems that you're free clear. Who can only have problems and can't have objects? Look at your scale of substitutes. You're free clear who can only have problems and can't have objects or even mock-ups or engrams and so forth, won't let go of a problem unless his happiness in terms of problems is remedied. So this goes into happiness too, doesn't it? Now, it's a big subject. It's a big process. It doesn't matter how real or unreal the objects are that you use to remedy happiness. I have done some very fantastic and wonderful things with this process. And every auditor around here has done some wonderful things with this process. Some of the strangest and goofiest things that happen to people on the remedy of happiness. And what do you think is happening to somebody who just got to have a body, who just got to have a body, and so forth? He just got a scarcity of bodies, that's right. The person that won't exteriorize has too great a scarcity of bodies. Okay?